Is our Goykin, CEO of Gibson Guitars. Thanks for having us in the Gibson Garage in Nashville.
Thank you for having me, Zach.
Cesar, what is the strangest thing about being the CEO of Gibson that an outsider probably has no idea is part of your everyday job?
That's a really good question. I think the general public sees what we're doing with artists or what's happening in social media, but there's a lot of work that goes behind the scenes in running a global business with operations all around the world with very complex logistics. And the concept of blending manufacturing with modern concepts that are also in celebration of craftsmanship. And just like any business, we have a lot of complexity. There's about 2,500 of us around the world with many different functions. And so most of my day, unlike what you might see in social media, is actually running the business.
So what does that mean? And is it different because you have a big business background? Is Gibson just another business that happens to have a very sexy product? Or is it actually a little different than running another type of business?
I think it's very different because of, on one hand, the history that we have, and therefore the need to pay tribute to the history, be a good custodian of that history, and then obviously be an even better steward of our future. But what we make is a very complex product. It's not something that can be outsourced. And so, you know, we control our own manufacturing facilities that we call crafteries, by virtue of the fact that there's a craft involved, which means it takes a lot of time to train people when they're joining us. Our expert luthiers and people that have been with us for decades get to train our newcomers. And so there's a lot of complexity that comes with our manufacturing process, the history that we have, and then the movement of that around the world. Because it's not an electronic made out of metal that can travel anywhere.
The moving of the goods around the world, that's what's complex.
Yeah, because we source, which is, you know, we use woods from all over the world, all the best toned woods around the world. We make, so we source, we make, we move, and we sell. And that is very complex when you're dealing with a guitar like ours.
When you came into Gibson around 2018, there was kind of this story that was forming that Gibson was getting a bad brand name, or there was a bad taste in the air about Gibson when you took it over, is what it kind of felt like. And you seem to have changed that narrative. And I don't think people really feel that way, or at least not nearly as much as they did about Gibson at the time. So how do you change that narrative? Because I'm sure that was a big part of when you took over, something that you realized had to be done, right?
I never really felt that.
Yeah.
I think that everybody that I spoke to, from the artist community to our own people, and then getting to interact with a lot of our fans, for example, in that first NAMM, it felt to me that everyone wanted to see Gibson succeed. And to me, it was about a couple of key ingredients that we had to do. One is re-engage with the artist community. They are the ones who make us relevant, and they inspire all of us at home to pick up and play because our favorite artist is playing that instrument. And then it was about going back to the core of Gibson, starting to go back to our history and our heritage and reestablish that objective for us internally of going after making the best guitars and the best quality guitars that we've ever made, because with Gibson, it all starts with the product. And I thought that if we focused on that and let's start letting those guitars speak for themselves, then getting those guitars in the hands of our artists, and if they decided they wanted to play them, that was a really good start. So that's really what we did. And I spent the first couple of months during 18 and early 19 in the factory, working with the team, rethinking what we were going to make and how we were going to make it. And that led to the original collection, the modern collection, custom shop historic. We launched the acoustic custom shop, and we launched the concept of the modern collection as well at the same time. So it was about doing those things and doing them right. And the other thing that I can tell you is there was a lot of contained knowledge within Gibson. And so just like our artists go on tour, I did a bit of a listening tour. And it was pretty remarkable to see how much knowledge our people had and how they wanted their ideas to be heard. They were all really good ideas. And so those were, I think, the first few things we did in order to achieve that.
How'd you though, so you go into the factory and you have a history as a guitar player, but not necessarily as a guitar builder. So you start walking around the factory and you're going, okay, we need to make sure this is the start of a great brand. It's going to start with the guitars. What are you looking for, or how are you interacting with people in the factory? How'd you figure out what needed to be done?
I didn't know how to build a guitar, but I knew what I wanted, because I had a collection of about 140 or so Gibsons by the time that we took it over. And I had been playing all my life, so I knew what I wanted. I knew what I wanted to see out of a Les Paul Standard or a J45 Standard or an SG or an Explorer and a Flying V. So I had a very good idea of what I wanted to
Which
see.
Which was a certain feeling and a sound right. within the guitar that you were chasing. That's what you were wanting.
I wanted to see I knew what features I wanted to see in that guitar. I knew how I like it to sound. And I knew how I would like it to look. And so that was the first thing, is thinking about what's going to be the feature value of these instruments. Then we thought about how are we going to make them. And yes, of course, I didn't know how to make a guitar, but it was pretty clear to me and to my team, we put together an amazing team, that there were many efficiencies that we could go after in our crafteries, particularly with the flow of how things were flowing in the craftery. And so we reorganized those locations so that there would be less touch points, the things would flow better from one stage to the next stage, as opposed to maybe a little bit of a spaghetti flow, which we inherited.
Just landed in LA, heading to NAMM. This is super exciting. Just want to say really quickly, if you're digging the channel, if you're digging the interview, I basically get nothing from this channel other than the fact that I love hosting these interviews, having these conversations. The only thing that really helps this channel truly is if you hit the subscribe button, click it right below. All right, let's get back to Cesar. Here we go.
How do you create great culture too? I've heard that you put a stage in the factory. Were you part of that? Was that your decision?
It was a collective decision,
but you're walking around the factory and you go, oh, we should have a stage in here so that our workers can perform and get up and play. Like, isn't that such a great idea at a Gibson factory?
But it was pretty obvious to me that when I walked in, it's like, where's the stage? And there was we don't have one. So, well, we need to put a stage. I mean, that seems to be like the first order of business, is to make sure that our people have a place where they can jam. And so that's happening usually now on Friday afternoons.
How else do you change the narrative? Because I know just from reading about it, you know, originally the factories used to place different orders and they were very competitive with each other. So you came in, you said, this is crazy. Like, we need to all work together. How do you start to change that? How do you start to create that environment where the different factories in Bozeman and Nashville and the custom shop can all work together to build better guitars for everyone, basically, right?
Yep. That wasn't that difficult, because it was about including everybody into the product development process. And so one of the things that we did, in addition to what we just talked about with product and artists, was, yes, restructure the company. So make it such that it was one company and one brand. And I put the product development team all together that was scattered into our different locations. So they all came together, marketing all came together, and so on. So everybody became one team in service to all of our brands and categories. So once you do that, everybody aligns themselves already.
And they were willing. They didn't feel competitive. They wanted to work together.
They wanted to do that. So that was pretty, that was a good thing we did early on. And then we started working together with the portfolio. So everybody participated now. They were all part of the same team and we're all working on developing our portfolio architecture and how things worked and were in sync and in harmony with each other. And that was how we did it. And like I said, there were many great ideas of what to do and how to do them. And so it was a collective decision. We had couple of months where we were whiteboarding ideas until we came up with it.
And that was it.
Yeah.
I'm loving following along on Instagram as you're building these CEO guitars. I think that was the number one question people said to me. They said, ask him about his CEO guitars. How did that project start for you where you decide, okay, I need to go into the factory and make my own guitars? And what have you learned through that process about the guitar building and also just about Gibson in general and how to run the company?
Yeah, it's a great question. So about 3.5, almost 4 years ago now, I thought I wanted to learn how to make a guitar from beginning to end, just to learn the process, and I decided to start with a Les Paul. And my initial thought was because I wanted the finished product. I wanted to get my hands on something that I had built from beginning to end. So I did that. I did it with the help of Jim DeCola, our master luthier, and all of our craftsmen and craftswomen in each step that had to help me. And I realized in the process of building it, which took me maybe 4 months going on Friday mornings, and obviously I can't go every Friday morning, but I tried to do it every Friday. I realized during that process that it wasn't about the guitar. It was about the process and the journey and getting to work with our people and getting them to teach me how to do something. It was very rewarding for me to spend time with our team learning something from them. And that was what really became my favorite part of the process. And I'll tell you a little anecdote. So when I finished that first one, during the Christmas, New Year's break, we give our people a break and we close the factories. We also take time to do cleanup, maintenance, things that we need to do that can only happen once we have everybody out. So there actually are people working and we're very grateful to those that have to work throughout the holidays, but we're not making instruments. And so I actually went with Jim between Christmas and New Year's to buff and then assemble that guitar. And it took me about 2.5 hours to buff the guitar, that Les Paul, something that probably takes 10 to 15 minutes for our trained people. And when I finished buffing it, there was a little thing on the headstock that I was like, oh, let's buff that out too. And I put the headstock on the buffing wheel and it yanked it out of my hands. And it went straight in a fraction of a second on the floor and it broke the headstock. So now I had to learn. Jim had to teach me how to fix a broken
headstock. He goes, all right, now we're going to fix the headstock because you broke it.
Which we did.
Yeah.
So we both were, looked down in panic. And I looked at Jim and I said, you need to teach me how to fix that. And so we went, we fixed it, we glued it. We had to do a little bit of work afterwards, of course, with spraying and buffing again. And that one I have. And so I call it CEO Zero. And then on the basis of that, which was a purple Les Paul, then I started with what really became, with no intention of it becoming that, it just started another one. And then I had somebody, I think Paige from our social media came to me and she said, can I film you while you're doing this? And I was like, sure. So there's no records of the first one. So she started with CO1, which is the second one. And that became a thing on social media. it's a very involved process to build a Gibson. You know, there are no bolts. Everything is working together. Everything is, you know, we use hide glue. The neck fitting is really critical. I learned a lot throughout the process. You know, I could have taken you around the factory before that and explained how we make guitars through each step. And you probably would think, wow, he really knows a lot about how to make guitars. I realized after that process that I knew really very little. It was very superficial. And when I started building, I really learned what it takes. And it's all documented on Gibson TV, the process. So you can go on Gibson TV and take a look at what it takes to build a Gibson, both electric and acoustic. And then every one of these guitars, as a result of it organically happened, it wasn't planned. They're all built with intention because I get to play them. Somebody invites me to play with them, one of our artists. So I get the luxury to be able to do that, play them on stage. We document that. And then we use those assets to auction those guitars. Sometimes it's somebody else playing them. It's an artist playing them. Kirk Hammett recently played one. And so they all get auctioned off and all of those proceeds go to Gibson Gives. And then we get to fund one of the many great causes that we fund around the world, one guitar at a time.
What are some of those things though that you just mentioned that you felt like you knew what they were, maybe binding, scraping, for example, and then you get in there and you go, oh, this is not what I thought it was. Like, what are some examples of where people might not be appreciating the craftsmanship that goes into a Gibson guitar?
The first thing that we don't really show that much is how we work with the wood when it comes into our rough mill. And that's a whole process in and of itself. When we start showing what we're doing, we're actually taking that as an input. But there's a lot of work that goes in the rough mill to make it look like a guitar shape. And also to get it to the moisture content that we need to start working on it, which is about 8 to 10%. So that part, but yeah, I mean, I can tell you binding is something that I still cannot do on my own. I need help. Neck fitting, no way I can do it. I just started at what we call Gibson USA. I just started CEO 10 through 15. I'm going to build 6 at a time now because they go into different stages. So it's better to have several going at the same time. And I still cannot do neck fit. I still need help. And buffing is really complicated. I don't know how those guys get, it's mostly men buffing, and then a lot of women are doing binding, scraping, because they have that finesse. And so there's that natural selection that happens in our crafteries, but I don't know how they do that because there's, even me wearing my glasses, They'll see things. I'm saying, how can you see that? So,
Where is the problem with net fitting? Where is the struggle that you're running into?
Well, neck fitting, what happens with the body and the neck once they're coming together is that by the time that's happening, they will have continued to expand and contract. So while we can cut them and make the space for the neck tendon to come in, it will continue to move. So they actually have to work with chisels to adjust it and get it right. And then once they are able to fit it, the angle needs to be perfect. So then they continue to work with it and continue to measure so that the angle is perfect. And if that's not perfect, it won't be playable. Whereas if you do something later to the, let's say I do something later to the guitar that's cosmetic, it's okay.
Right.
It wouldn't be a sellable grade if it were the guitar that I'm building, but you know, there's a little cosmetic thing here or there, it doesn't affect playability, but neck fitting will. So there's a couple of steps like that are really complicated. So it was a huge learning process.
Are you hell-bent on becoming a master of every step and getting that neck to fit perfectly? Is that something that's really important to you, or you feel like just to get in there and get your hands on it gives you the right appreciation that you needed from this project?
I want to learn, but it's okay for me to take a little longer to learn because I'm in no rush. And yeah, I get the chance to go, let's say once a week and do it. So over time, I feel like I will be able to learn it. I don't know if I'll get to the point where I can do something on my own from beginning to end. Most likely not. Most likely I will continue to need help.
And how hard is that to scrape that binding? That's always mind-blowing to me when you watch them it online, right?
The binding is, it is mind-blowing because if anybody goes in a fraction of a millimeter, it's a repair.
They spray paint the entire guitar, not spray paint, but they spray the entire guitar because it's just easier, and then someone has to go in and carve the binding. You can watch them do it on YouTube.
Yep.
It's always mind-blowing to me.
We've tried. We've tried taping it. We've tried multiple different ways of making it easier for our people afterwards, and nothing has worked.
Yep.
So we continue to scrape it the old-fashioned way.
Right, exactly. We are sitting here in the Gibson Garage in Nashville. Gibson Garage just opened in London somewhat recently. There's a new one coming to Miami. The whole point of the Gibson Garage was to create the Gibson experience because you felt like there was no place for the Gibson experience that Gibson owned. You could go to a guitar store, but Gibson didn't own that experience. How have you been judging the success of the Gibson Garages, and what do you look at? You know, what has it done for the brand building these spaces?
The garages were very important to me because, and I always like borrowing from something that Bernard Arnault said, which is if you control your manufacturing production, then you control quality. And if you control distribution, you control your image. And we didn't control our image. We had the production side, but we didn't have the place where we would control our image and our experience. And so the garage, our vision for it was to be a place where when you walked in, I didn't have to explain anything to you about what Gibson is. You would walk in and you would say, this is Gibson. I get it now. And that's what we tasked Mark Ignisi with, is design a place when people come in, they get the Gibson experience. And we need to own that. And also we need to show our partners, all of the dealers around the world, it's a great place for us to show them what we mean by it. And so it's worked extremely well. It's done just that. Our team is trained to be incredibly friendly and welcoming. One of the things that I really love that both Brian May and Tony Iommi told me, that they love the garage because when they were kids and they used to go to guitar stores, they were really intimidating. But now they see young kids coming into the Gibson garages, and they were making the comment of the garage in London, and they're seeing how they're able to pick up anything. Our team is working, helping them. Anything they want to try is available. And obviously we activate it with a lot of shows so people get to come and watch live music. It's highly connected to our communities in Nashville and in London. So it's become a bit of, it's covered multiple objectives for us. It's the place where you can get the Gibson experience and the rest of our brands. It's the place where maybe you can watch some live music. It's the place where a lot of community events are happening. And you can come and try anything you want. You want to try a custom shop greenie? Please come. Try it. In fact, you want to come and try a Gibson certified vintage 50s guitar? You can. So it's something that we're going to continue to expand. And we're not going to have hundreds of locations because we have amazing dealer partners around the world that are also, those that are winning are delivering great service, but we are going to continue to have select locations where we control the experience.
How essential is that to creating, or how much of a part of the plan is that for creating just Gibson fandom and love where you can go to a space like this and just feel immersed in Gibson? And does that create more dedicated fans or fans that are obsessive over the brand. Is that a piece of the puzzle?
It's not our objective, but I think it's happening. I think by virtue of delivering a great experience, having great activations, great music, great assortment, friendly staff that can help you even if you don't know and they're teaching you how to play your first chord, then that naturally will happen.
Is the goal of the garages to also sell a lot of guitars out of the garages, or is the goal that they come into the space, feel inspired, and then go buy the guitars elsewhere, or is it a little bit of both?
The objective wasn't initially to have revenue metrics and targets.
Yeah.
It was to have an experience place, but it became very successful as a flagship retail location. And so we are very lucky that that worked out well. I think it was part also as a result of not cluttering it and making it a great experience when you walk in and having space. And so maybe we are breaking with retail, you know, metrics and objectives, but we're doing it our way.
These spaces, though, when you go into them, they feel so expensive in a good way. They just feel very detailed and great. So how do you, what were the metrics you were looking at, if any, or how do you justify putting so much money into a space that maybe the main goal wasn't to sell guitars out of initially?
Well, we wanted the space to be at the level of what you would expect of Gibson. So as you expect the guitars to be of a certain quality, you know, you probably expect Gibsons to be of the best quality guitars that you could get, then we have to create a space that is exactly the same. And so when we were looking at the budget, something Mark hated.
Because it was high or low?
No, Mark hated because he didn't want to have a budget.
Oh, he didn't want a budget at all.
But I said to Mark, no, you don't worry about it. I'm not going to hold you down. I just want to make sure that what you're coming up with is in service to the Gibson brand and is premium. It's perceived as premium and aspirational and everything that the Gibson brand represents. And what we want to have is what we want to achieve is when you walk in, you're wowed. And that's happened not just with our customers and fans around the world. It's happened with our artists, too. They walk in and it's like, wow, this is amazing. So we have to have the quality of the Gibson garages needs to be there because it needs to match the quality of our image.
Right. We're going to do some rapid fire questions here. And these are going to be very important, okay? People are going to care a lot about these answers. So here we go. First question, Cesar, you've been in the back end, you've seen the books, or at least what's there of them in terms of the ledgers that are missing. Do you believe there is a Modern guitar out there from the 50s?
Yeah.
You think there is? Why do you think so?
I think there's one guitar. I know we made one. Let me rephrase. I know we made one.
I have chills. Why?
I don't know if it was scrapped or if it's out there.
How do you know that? Can I ask? Or is this...
We have records from the 50s that indicate that we made one.
Really? So I have chills about this. So you saw a record. Were you searching for that? To me,
no.
That's like...
No, I just stumbled upon it. And clearly, if that guitar is still out there, it would probably be the most valuable guitar.
It would be, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Cesar, the CEO of Gibson, can you give us the five most essential guitar store licks? This is going to go viral on social media right here. Like the licks that you might play in a guitar store, like Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, the things like, that we don't want you to play here?
Exactly. Yeah.
Oof, that's a great question. Well, Stairway.
They're just your top five guitar store licks.
Yeah, well, Stairway to Heaven is number one, and we actually have a sign. I showed it to both Robert Plant and Jimmy Page. I took them there and I showed it to them. This applies to you too, I said. But Sweet Child of Mine, Enter Sandman, Paranoid, Sweet Home Alabama, and Stairway to Heaven.
That's a great list right there. Your top five guitar store licks. Okay, can you give us for you and your history and love of guitar players, what do you think are the top five most iconic individual Gibson guitars? So not the models, but a specific guitar that a player played or something.
Okay. Greeny.
Greeny is number one.
Greeny, which is in...
It's very high on the list.
Kirk Hammett's collection to me is very important. The Monkey SG Tony used to create the heavy metal genre. The reason why I play guitar. Jimmy Page, number one and number two. So I guess we have four there already.
We'll count that as one.
We'll count it as one, okay. This is very, some people are not gonna like this, but to me, because of how much that music meant to be to me, is Slash's replica.
The Chris Derringer.
Yes, the replicated one. And then again, to me, I'm might be controversial, but Adam Jones and Tool and what he did to music, it was hugely influential in me and my upbringing and my playing. So he's 1979 Les Paul Custom.
That's a good answer. Any update on the Back to the Future guitar?
The Back to the Future, well, we have received a lot of information through the Lost to the Future and losttothefuture.com. So first, maybe is a thank you to everybody that I think a big thank you actually goes to the Back to the Future cast that helped us, and then to everybody that contributed around the world to send information. We've made a lot of progress, I can tell you that, but we are still trying to finalize that search, and so stay tuned. More information. It's very much alive.
I hope you guys find it. If anyone's gonna find it, it's gonna be you guys. I want to sort of talk about this to wrap. We're starting to wrap up, but for me, it's like all I want to do is own a really significant vintage Gibson guitar, and they get so expensive. For someone looking to enter the vintage Gibson game, any suggestions about where to start? Could be anything. Could be a model. Could be how to find it, how to get it. How can someone just get into the vintage game with Gibson guitars?
So this is my personal opinion. I believe that our late 70s Les Paul Customs are some of the best guitars we've ever made. And they're a really good entry point into vintage. And so those are out there. I have a big collection of late 70s and early 80s Les Paul Customs. And then from the 50s and early 60s, our juniors and specials are great value. They were made alongside all of the other instruments that go for hundreds of thousands and millions. And so those are great value to enter the vintage market. And you know, we have Gibson Certified Vintage. It's worthwhile always checking to see what we have on Certified Vintage. It's been a great success for us. Imagine for me, I always thought it about this way when we were thinking about and designing the program. If I had Gibson as a trusted source to buy vintage guitars where I could get a new lifetime warranty, a certificate of vintage authenticity. In other words, Gibson is certifying that it's original, so that would give me peace of mind. We've been delivering that, and so I think it's always worthwhile checking and to see what we have there. There's not always things that are hundreds of thousands. We most likely always at some point have, or at any given point in time, we have things that are great entry points into a vintage collection.
I always go on there and check every now and then. It's fun to scroll through what you guys curate. Any leads for the 59 Ledger? Are you guys still offering $59,000 to whoever presents it?
Very much so. We have not found it. I know that's out there.
This is another calling right here that we're throwing out there into the world.
Definitely call to action. If you know where it is, to please let us know, and we're still offering that reward.
What keeps you up at night as the CEO of Gibson, and where do you think the brand is heading?
That's a really good question. As CEO, ultimately, I'm here to make a small number of high-quality decisions, including finding the right A players and putting them in the right seats. So creating the conditions so that they can lead the company into the future, and giving them the right conditions and support so that they can create a situation where our future is more promising and brighter than our past. And that's a tough order, right? Because our past is pretty epic. I mean, that's really what I'm here to do. And I always think about that.
Do you feel like we're always going to look back on the golden ages being the 50s and the 60s? Or do you feel like the brand can create new golden ages moving forward?
I think we can create the right set of circumstances for that to happen. But that has to be judged by the artist community and our fan community. It's not up to us.
Fair enough. Cesar Goycan, the CEO of Gibson. When you used to work in private equity, right? That was kind of where you started.
Yeah.
Did you feel like that business, from the way you were working in it, was it tapping that itch and love of rock and roll? Did it feel rock and roll to you, or did it feel like a desk job and you were just waiting for this gig?
Oh, no, it was really exciting because I got to work with many businesses around the world and management teams. In some cases, businesses that needed help. In other cases, businesses that were growing in a very nice way already. So I got to see a lot of different business circumstances and then also many different industries and management teams. So it was a very exciting time, and it was a highly educational, you know, 2 decades plus. And now I get a chance to apply all of that and everything I've learned with Gibson, but combine that with my biggest passion, which is not just music and guitars, but it's always been Gibson. I told you earlier, I had about 140 Gibsons in my collection by the time we took the business over, starting from when I was 10 years old and I had a nylon string at home, and that's what I learned and that's what I had. And I, you know, didn't have an electric guitar. So it's getting to apply everything I learned while I was in the private equity world, working with so many different companies around the world, and putting it together with what I love the most.
So you didn't feel boxed in, like, oh, I need to get out there and play guitar or whatever. You felt like that was rock and roll, and this job's also rock and roll.
I always played. I always had music with me, and I played with multiple bands and wrote, recorded. So, no, I always had music with me.
Who's been one of the most, not exciting people, but which person, artist, celebrity that you've gone to work with do you feel has lived up the closest to the persona that they create of themselves?
I really don't have one. They've all been so gracious and so incredible human beings. Developed relationships with many of the artists that you see that I interact with. And what's been most incredible for me is to get to know them as people. As not as the rock star. All of those accolades speak for themselves. But getting to know them as people and interacting with them just like I'm talking with you. And maybe even the most magical thing for me is for them to feel like I have something to add, and they ask me questions, you know, from my past and from my business background, and the fact that they trust me with things they want to know, just like I trust them in what we're doing with them, has been probably the most rewarding part.
Cesar, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Great to meet you.
Thank you for having me.
We're wrapping up here with Cesar Goycan, the CEO of Gibson, in the Gibson Garage in Nashville. This place is epic. Come on down. We'll see you next time.